We're interrupting this program to bring you the most exciting piece of news that's happened since the war.
Anything can happen in the next hour.
Who else has electricity streaming from his eyeballs and from his fingers?
Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
You said I was an enemy of society? All right, I'll show you what I think of your society.
You're talking about cause and effect in the outside world. We're not living in the outside world.
You know, it's a pity you weren't born a girl.
Yes, I've always envied you that.
Welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast.
Paleo Cinema Podcast looks at movies between 1895 and 1990. We cover all mainstream and genre films, books, TV, and whatever else Terry gets obsessed about. The email address is cultguru@gmail.com. That's cultguru@gmail.com. The new voicemail number is 206-350-5440, or you can leave messages on Skype at Paleo Cinema, all lowercase and no dash. This podcast may include swearing and adult content, so if you hear anything you don't understand, just fucking Google it.
Hi, how are we going, people? Things here are fine. Again, winter is lingering way too long in this part of the planet, and I don't like it one tiny bit. But there are some good things happening. First one is next week, the World Science Fiction Convention is in Melbourne. I will be attending the convention. I'm also on four panels, one of which is a doubled up one, but I'll be on four panels during the convention, and if anybody is going there, please stop and say hello. Very happy to have a chat with people. Looking forward to it a lot. I'll be hanging out there for 5 days solid with my peeps and just enjoying the hell out of it. The convention's also done something very groovy. They have an iPhone app, and I got really oddly pleased that my name appeared in an iPhone app. It's totally stupid, totally unreasonable, totally nuts, but I was very, very chuffed by that. As you can see, I'm easily pleased by attention. So that's coming up, and I'm looking forward to that. I've got to tell you about this movie. Sal and I rented some movies, and unfortunately, we rented Date Night. Now, I don't know what I was expecting when I saw this film. Sal enjoyed it, which I'm not taking anything away from her. She has different tastes than me on some things. That's perfectly fine. No problem there. But, oh, fucking hell. It was cliched. It was stupid. It was middle of the road. It went for the obvious shtick for its two stars, Steve Carell and Tina Fey. It wasted actors like William Fichtner and Ray Liotta. It was horrible. It was just so... Oh, I really wanted to pluck my eyes out with a fucking blunt spoon. It's not entertainment. It's like a middle-of-the-road sitcom episode with an enormous budget. It does the obvious thing, kooky car chase, people breaking the law who don't normally break the law and doing it really clumsily and stupid. There's a lot of slapstick in there. It amused me not at all. Mark Wahlberg took his shirt off, and there was lots of talk about Mark Wahlberg taking his shirt off, and where all he does in the film basically is stand around with his shirt off in an apartment with a sexy Israeli girlfriend. That's basically what he does. He's just there as a plot contrivance, and it is just, it's indescribable. Yeah, it's just a fucking dog's breakfast, the whole lot of it, and yeah, and I'm not dissing Sal for wanting to see it and enjoying it. All strength to her. I'm sure there's a major audience for it, and I'm sure it did very well, but not this little black duck. Did not enjoy it at all, and I just thought, what a waste of everything. So I was actually surprised by the extremity of my reaction to a relatively innocuous movie, but maybe I'm getting impatient with stuff that has potential to quality but doesn't really go there. So that was one. And the other one is Zom. I've got to apologise, Dr. Zom. I did try to watch Antichrist. I gave it a go. But for reasons to do with things happening in my life and some medical issues in the family, really not comfortable watching it right at the moment. I will watch it, and when I do, I'll mention it in the podcast, but there are personal reasons why about 20 minutes into it, I really couldn't take it further than I did. So I apologise for that. The other one was Unmanned Withering in Zygo. I did get that one suggested to me, I think, by Richard in Wichita. Haven't had a chance to watch that yet. I've been busy watching stupid Steve Carell comedies. But thank you for that. I do have a copy of it. It is on my list. It's on my thumb drive that I plug into the DVD player, ready to go. Just haven't had a chance to get around to it. But when I do, I will give my opinion of it in Paleo Cinema here. The other thing I should mention is, yes, Australia had its federal election. We all went down there and did our bit. There was not a sausage sizzle. They usually have people selling sausages on bread at polling stations, but for some reason my local one did not have a sausage sizzle. Sally and I have now decided we're not going to vote there anymore, because you need to, it's all part of the event of having an election. So there was an election, but nobody won. We have what they call a hung parliament, which is not as good as it sounds. It means that there was no clear winner, and a whole bunch of shit-kicking redneck politicians who were independents get the balance of power, so they get to have other people dance to their tune. It's all very interesting, but I would have liked a clear result. There's a lot of talk about it, fixing up the electoral process and making everything wonderful and politically groovy, but we will see. So a week out after the election, we don't really know who's going to be Prime Minister here yet, and long term. I mean, at the moment, Julia Gillard's acting Prime Minister until the shit settles, but yeah, pretty fucking weird for an Australian election. So, what have I been watching that was not a Tina Fey, Steve Carell movie? I did see The Ghost Rider, the Roman Polanski movie. Now, Roman Polanski, of course, being a controversial figure because he likes to diddle young girls. To be fair, and to everybody except Roman Polanski, I didn't pay to see this film, so I'm not giving money to somebody who may ostensibly be a pedophile. But I did watch it. Ewan McGregor's in it. Pierce Brosnan's in it. Ghost Rider's a very old-fashioned movie in a way. Polanski being in his 70s. It's an old-style thriller. And I don't know. It seems like a movie slightly out of time. And I think also that the political aspect of it, the upshot, the end of the plot line, the revelation at the end, I'm not too sure at how shocking it is. I don't know whether the author of the novel and Polanski really realise it, but what they're proposing isn't really shocking to most people. The last scene is fantastic. I've got no issue with that. It's very well filmed and amusing, but not my kind of film. I also saw Salt, the Phil Noyce directed Angelina Jolie action film, and yeah, it really does work. I like Angelina in films a lot. I'm still getting used to her lips, but I'll live with it. And Phil Noyce, the Australian director, does a very good job of the action scenes, and it's an intelligent action film in a lot of ways. As you might know, they were originally going to film it with Tom Cruise, and Salt was going to be a guy. But they fell through for some reason. They decided to go with Angelina, and I think it was a great decision, replacing the short weirdo with a chick. And I do like the film. It works. It's got some lovely reverses in it. There's a couple of very good reverses in the plot line, which work incredibly well. One of the issues I have with action films in general is the shaky cam and the quick cutting to cover up sloppy action. It's hard to tell who is where doing what to whom in an action scene. And I had no trouble with that with Salt. It works really well as an action film. Angelina kicks ass in it. And it does leave it open-ended for a series of movies. I'm not going to do any spoilers on it, so you don't actually need them to know that you should see the film. Phil Noyce's films are always interesting. I even liked his Val Kilmer version of The Saint. I don't think it's a perfect film by any means, but I kind of like it. I like the kind of Eurospy sensibility to it and the international man of intrigue kind of vibe. And I do like Val Kilmer in various disguises doing various things. I like him as an actor. In fact, I've got a copy of MacGruber, the movie where he plays the villain in the film, a guy called Dieter von Kunth. I'm going to see that later on today, so looking forward to a little bit of chilling out with a comedy that may actually be funny. And yes, I am going to refer to Date Night repeatedly during this podcast. What else have I seen? I'm just getting my iPhone out because all of my life information for some reason ends up on my iPhone. I saw Kick-Ass. Yeah, I did. I liked it. I mean, yeah, the hit girl thing didn't worry me. There was, unlike the graphic novel where there is some much, much darker overtones to the Big Daddy hit girl dynamic, this one kind of works as a movie. It kind of, Nick Cage, of course, has a lot of tongue-in-cheek fun with it. Mark Strong, who seems to be having a career playing villains these days, is great in it. The younger leads, who have names nobody can ever remember, were pretty good in it as well. Yeah, it's worked. So we picked it up on Blu-ray because where we can, we're getting Blu-rays at the moment. The price differential is not that large between a new release Blu-ray and a new release DVD these days, which, of course, may be a deliberate marketing thing. But picked it up, and yeah, we liked it. Sal had a little bit of a problem with the hit girl thing and how, yeah, that discomfort level with somebody that young saying the things she does and doing the things she does. But I think that's part of the edge to it. She's still kind of undecided about that, but I can understand why she is. But definitely worth checking out. Haven't seen anything else really, really memorable. Been watching a few Brit coms and TV series and things like that. But again, nothing to write home about. So I'm going to take a break now, and then I'll start talking about movies, which would be, well, the movies that we're going to talk about this time around. As I said last time, this is a science fiction special, and the three movies that I am reviewing this time around are the original version of The Fly from 1958. Then I'm going to dip into the 1960s and look at La Decima Vittima, The Tenth Victim, starring Marcello Mastroianni and Ursula Andress. And then I'm zipping into the 1970s to look at The Final Program, a 1970s film based on a Michael Moorcock novel starring John Finch, Jenny Ronico, and a bunch of character actors. And then I'm also going to talk about a book that I was given to review by somebody. So plenty to do there. I'm taking a break, and then I'll be back to talk about films.
She turned away and said, "Once I loved, but love is dead." And I whispered, "Sometimes love is only sleeping." She said, "I cannot cry, and I cannot give or feel or even try." And her voice was hard and cold. Then her sweet young face looked old, and I whispered, "Sometimes love is only sleeping." Through the endless days and nights, she could not help but wrap herself in sorrow,
sorrow.
Through the endless days and nights, we waited for a shining new tomorrow. Love was sleeping.
Her eyes as it mingled with our sighs, and she whispered, "Sometimes love is only sleeping."
And she whispered, "Sometimes love is only sleeping, only sleeping, only sleeping."
Oh,
That, of course, was The Monkees with their hit Love Is Only Sleeping, which is from the album Pisces, Aquarius, Capricorn and Jones Limited. Yeah, I was a Monkees fan in the 70s, so actually in the 60s, come to think of it, which is more than a few birthdays ago. I don't particularly care that they were a manufactured band because they were manufactured by people like Jack Nicholson and Bob Rafelson. So that gives them at least a little bit of street cred. So moving along, I'm going to do the book review first. Mike White contacted me. He is involved in Cashiers du Cinéma magazine, and he's got a new book out of essays from that magazine, Cashiers du Cinéma. And it's called Impossibly Funky, a Cashiers du Cinéma collection. And he gave me a copy of it. And yeah, I like it. It's fantastic. It's dedicated to Rudy Ray Moore, the baddest mother who ever lived. So that's always a nice thing. And it contains, as I said, a bunch of essays from that. The first group of essays in it are about Quentin Tarantino's first movie, Reservoir Dogs, and the parallels between that and the Chow Yun-Fat movie, City of Fire. So there's a whole bunch of essays on that. There was a big scandal at the time because Mike White put together a short film comparing the two movies, and it did get into a New York Film Festival, and there was some to and froing in the media about it. It's good to just get the history of that from his side, and just showing that we all know Tarantino since then has moved on and does things of incredible originality, kind of mashing up various genres and various film tropes and things like that. But going back to the early years of Tarantino, it's good to remember that what a controversial figure he was at the time of his first great success. Now, there are a whole bunch of other great articles on there. There's one about the movies of David Goodis, a couple of which I picked up but haven't really had time to watch yet. There's an essay on James Ellroy. There's one on the Richard Stark Parker novels, which the movie Point Blank was based on. One of the articles that I really liked was a script-based article about, it's called Travis McGee and the Lonely Silver Screen. And what it does is it looks at the various attempts to bring John D. McDonald's crime character, Travis McGee, I love the Travis McGee novels, to the screen. And there's a lot of great information about that. There's a look at the various attempts to get the Hulk on the screen. There's a look at an original Gremlin script that came along beforehand. There are looks at various scripts that were made for Indiana Jones sequels, and one that Grant Watson might like about the various scripts that were made for Alien 3 before it came out. Grant, in his podcast, Bad Film Diaries, did a whole episode about Alien 3 and about the various iterations of the story that eventually emerged. So that's good. There are interviews with Bruce Campbell, Monty Hellman, Dr. Demento, James Ellroy, Keith Gordon, and Crispin Glover. So pretty cool stuff there. There's a look at some Star Wars movies, and basically no interest there for me. Don't like them at all. There are a whole bunch of different articles about Black Shampoo, black exploitation film from the 1970s that I reviewed in an earlier podcast. And a whole bunch of other stuff. So it's chock full of cinematic goodness, very much in the vein of the kind of stuff that I like, and I know that a lot of other people like there. So I'll just give you the title of the film one more time. It's Impossibly Funky, a Cashiers du Cinéma collection. And I recommend it highly. It's a lot of fun. And it's got a foreword by Herschel Gordon Lewis, and also another one from Chris Gore. So give that a go. Go out there and get it. If you type in Impossibly Funky into Google, I think you may well find it there. And good job, Mike. I did enjoy it very much. If you go to paleocinema.blogspot.com, you'll see the book trailer for the book and a link to where you can find out more information about buying it. When I was trying to figure out which science fiction movies to do for this podcast, I always seem to get stuck with science fiction films. I really do get stuck with the problem of science fiction movies have been done to death. They've been analysed and autopsied and vivisected and cut to pieces and reassembled. And it's a difficult thing to do because there's been so many people in the paddock beforehand ploughing it. And so when I decided I was going to do this science fiction podcast, I really wanted to look at films I found interesting, but films that weren't necessarily the big ones that everybody had had gone over and really regurgitated a bit. So with that in mind, I decided to have a go at three films. First one being the 1959 version of The Fly, directed by Kurt Neumann, a director who left Germany when the Nazis were starting to do their thing there, and became a kind of B-movie director in Hollywood. He actually came to America in the early talkie era and was hired to direct German language versions of Hollywood films. And once he mastered English and established himself, he directed low budget things like The Big Cage, Secret of the Blue Room. Didn't do tremendously well, and he ended up doing Tarzan movies with Johnny Weissmuller and later on Gordon Scott. This is probably the movie for which The Fly is probably the movie for which he is best known. I'll just play a bit of the film and then I'll get into talking about it.
It's astounding! It works!
I test ran it this morning. It's all right.
You succeeded completely. It's unbelievable.
Oh, we'll have to wait and see. I'll know for sure in a few weeks.
I don't understand.
I have to see if it suffers from any ill effects. Oh. If it's alive in, say, a month, then we'll pronounce the experiment successful.
May I look after him?
It's still a her, but you can't.
For one whole month, she's mine.
Now, don't kill her with overfeeding.
It's a little frightening, isn't it?
Yes. The first live experiment was disastrous. Dandolo.
Dandolo? Andre, how could you?
She disintegrated perfectly, but never reappeared. I don't know why, even now. I redesigned the projecting device, and now it's perfect.
Well, where's she gone?
Into space. A stream of cat atoms. It'd be funny if life weren't so sacred.
Andre, promise me one thing. No more experiments with animals.
I promise. No more experiments with animals.
Okay, The Fly, basically. Everybody knows the plot, so I don't even know why I'm bothering with that, but I'll go through it just for people who are maybe a bit noob in the realm of science fiction films. Canadian scientist André Lalonde's head and arm are crushed in a hydraulic press. His wife Helene confesses to the crime. Helene is obsessed with flies, particularly a white-headed fly. André's brother Francois lies and says he caught it. Thinking he knows the truth, Helene tells how it happened. In flashback, André, Helene, and their son Philippe are a happy family. André has been working on a matter transporter device, the disintegrator integrator. It works, but not quite perfectly. He refines it and eventually builds a man-sized pair of chambers. Helene, worried since André has not come up from the basement for a couple of days, goes down to investigate. André lets her in, but he has a black cloth over his head, etc., etc., etc. This is a bit of a classic, really. It's a very atypical science fiction film in a way, because like the short story by George Langerlands that it's based on, it starts out as a police procedural. They find the corpse of André in the factory that he and his brother Francois own, and he's been crushed by an enormous hydraulic press twice, not once but twice. So the police come and investigate, and the brother helps them with the investigation, and slowly unfolds the story of how and why André was crushed by the hydraulic press, and it turns out in the end that it's a form of assisted suicide. But there's a twist to it, of course, as there always is. Now, most of you know the plot of this film. It's the same thing as the Cronenberg one, only better. The Cronenberg one kind of played to the gore factor, and this one stays more true to the source material. I really shouldn't diss the Cronenberg version, the 1986 Cronenberg version with Jeff Goldblum and Gina Davis in it too much. It's a different film in a different age, and though it has the basic some of the basic plot structure of the original. It definitely goes off into a 1980s horror tangent. But the original short story actually is a lot more icky than the 1958 film. In the film, I'd played you before the little bit about where he tells about having unsuccessfully teleported a cat. Now, let's drop the spoilers. Everybody knows the story on this one. So basically, here's the situation. He gets his head and one of his arms replaced by a fly's. And then, of course, conversely, there is a fly out there which has a human head and human arm attached to it. Scientifically, this makes absolutely no sense because flies' heads aren't that big and human heads aren't that small. And the cardiovascular system, the blood system, the endocrinological system, the neurological system, every system just wouldn't match up for 1 second. Even the structure of the flesh is totally different between a fly and a human being, as we all know. So the science doesn't make sense, and in this sense, that's the fudge we'll give it. We'll give it the fudge that this basically is bullshit science, but you're allowed to have one bullshit science thing in any good science fiction movie, and this one has that. In the story, I digress there into a science fiction fanboy wonkle there. Basically, in the original short story, the second time Andre goes through the machine trying to integrate himself a little more, some of the cat's DNA atoms, whatever, integrates into his own. So not only is he part man, part fly, he's part man, part fly, part cat. And that's the action that precipitates his decision to crush himself with a hydraulic press in the original story. It's not just that he's a fly, it's that his genes are totally fucked up with cat genes and fly genes and everything else. And there's really no upside to going on anymore. There's no way he can undo the cat thing. There's no way he can undo the fly thing anymore. So that's it. And also the character of Helene in this film, played by Patricia Owens, commits suicide in the original short story. It's quite a dark story in a sense, and quite a tragic one. I think it would have played well had the people who made it been able to do it as the original short story. But of course, this being the late 1950s, there are certain things that you can't do in a story. You can't make them horrific up beyond a certain point. And the idea of a character committing suicide, there was the production code problems with that kind of a part of a story. The script for the film, by the way, it's getting on to less icky bits. The script of the film was written by James Clavell, a writer who spent a long time in Australia. He was actually a prisoner in Changi Jail in Singapore during World War II. The Japanese caught him when they captured Singapore, and he lived there with a lot of Australian soldiers and for a period of time moved to Australia. He went on to write a whole bunch of very, very successful novels like Shogun and other ones that were later made into TV miniseries in the 1980s. But he didn't do many scripts for movies and things, but this was one of them. The budget for the entire film was only $500,000. It was made by 20th Century Fox. I'm sure they made their money back on this one, if not immediately over the years, because it is full tilt boogie horror and very influential upon other things. It's one of those movies that people see when they're a kid and they remember it fondly for the next zillion years. There are two sequels to the film, Return of the Fly in 1959 and Curse of the Fly in 1965, neither of which is really worth anything. There's also been kind of name-checked and referenced in a whole bunch of popular culture stuff like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle. There was an episode of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles where a guy transformed into a human-fly hybrid. There's Fly vs. Fly segment in a Simpsons episode, Treehouse of Horror 8. And then the movie was also parodied in the Disney film, The Emperor's New Groove, where Kuzco goes into the jungle and sees a regular fly crying out, help me, before it's devoured by a scary-looking black spider. And, of course, it's one of the influences on the film within a film in Joe Talante's 1993 film Matinee. The movie Mant, the man ant, is partly a reference to the fly. So, yeah, this film really does have a kind of iconic status in a sense. But one of the other issues when the film was being made, I mean, Vincent Price is playing a very atypical role. He's a kind, gentle character in this film who's secretly in love with his sister-in-law and wants the best for the family, and he's a religious man, and he's quite peaceful and mellow, and only under extreme circumstances would he even hurt a fly. But one of the problems they had was this film in the end scene. Herbert Marshall, who played the police inspector, and Vincent Price had a real problem filming this scene because they got the fits of their giggles, as you would under the circumstances. It's an absurdly silly piece of film, and you've really got to kind of accept that to play it. So they filmed them separately. They were actually not on the set at the same time when they were filming the face-to-face bit of that scene. Now, again, yeah, they were aware of the absurdity of what they were doing when they were making the film. And I think a lot of horror films, when people are putting together the bits and pieces, are innately absurd. But one of the interesting things about Herbert Marshall is he had a long career on stage and in film from the 1920s onwards. In World War One, he actually lost one of his legs. So he was a man of a certain asymmetry. And one of the... And in spite of that, he still went on to have a successful career. He was never going to play a marathon runner. But basically, he did well overcoming the tragic thing that happened when he was quite a young man. Actually, I'll read a bit from Victoria Price's biography of her father about the bit on the fly. About that last scene, it says, while filming the scene, neither actor was able to maintain a straight face. According to Vincent, the more they tried to regain their professional composure, the more ludicrous the whole thing seemed, and they both dissolved into helpless giggles. Each successive take only made it worse, until both men were sitting on the ground with tears of laughter streaming down their faces. Nobody knows exactly how many takes director Kurt Newman required to finally get it right. So there you go. It grossed over $3 million, by the way. So they definitely made the money back on the film. And, I mean, I like it. It's not a film I watch particularly often. But I do like it because it's one of those first films that, even though the science is absurd, it takes it seriously. And it personalises the horror, the whole way the 1950s domestic situation with the mum and the dad and the precocious, cute, silly kid are shattered by the impact of science is a theme that very much was a part of 1950s science fiction cinema. So there is that. But I mean, there are a couple of bits that jarred on this viewing of the film for me. One of which is that the kid's a bit insufferable. The young actor playing the kid, I suppose a lot of kids in 1950s movies were pretty much insufferable and acted pretty much nothing at all like we know children act. They were kind of constructs of the group mind of society in the 1950s. They weren't in any real way reality-based at all. And the other weakness in the film, I think, is the actress who plays Helene, Patricia Owens, isn't particularly good in some scenes. I mean, there are some scenes there that are pretty hard to play, even for a highly competent actor. And I don't think that she carries it across as well as perhaps some other actress would. Maybe because the film didn't really expect somebody to be a fantastic actor to carry the story, but I would have liked to have seen a little more depth. Maybe I'm getting picky in my old age and like things to be intensely real, even when they're absurdly unreal. But yeah, it was just one of the things that slightly put me off on this viewing of the film. I don't know. Tell me how you feel about that, whether you think Patricia Owens maybe isn't up to what's required of her in the movie. And also, any other really bad acting in 1950s or 60s science fiction or horror movies. Just let me know a little bit about what you think on that side of things.
Do flies live a long time?
I don't know. Why?
Because I saw that fly Mummy was looking for again.
Oh, I didn't know your mother was looking for one.
Oh, yes, she was. It's grown quite a lot. But I recognized it all right.
How did you recognize it, Vinny?
Its head is white instead of black, and it has a funny sort of leg. It was on your desk this morning.
Oh, I didn't notice it. When did you first see that fly, Philippe?
The day Daddy went away. I had caught it, but Mummy made me let it go. And then later, she wanted me to find it again. She changed her mind. You know how women are.
Okay, that's it for the fly. I'm going to take another break now and come back, and I will talk about the second of our three films, La Decima Vittima, The Tenth Victim, starring Marcello Mastroianni and Ursula Andress. Americana come cacciatore numero 14.332 e il signor Marcello Poletti italiano come vittima numero 14.879. That is The Big Computer in Geneva from the movie La Decima Vittima. The Tenth Victim, starring Marcello Mastroianni and Ursula Andress, as I said. And it's interesting to hear what the Italians thought of as a computer voice in the 1960s. Now, as I said, this is an Italian film directed by Elio Petri in 1965. It's based on a short story by an American science fiction writer, Robert Shickley, a 1953 short story called Seventh Victim. And Shickley also published a novelization of the film in 1966. I'll give you a bit of a plot synopsis on this one. In the near future, big wars are avoided by giving individuals with violent tendencies a chance to kill in the big hunt. The hunt is the most popular form of entertainment in the world and also attracts participants who are looking for fame and fortune. It includes 10 rounds for each competitor, 5 as the hunter, the cacciatore, and 5 as the victim. The survivor of 10 rounds becomes extremely wealthy and retires. Scenes switch between the pursuit, romance between the hunter and the victim, and a narrator explaining the rules and the justification of the hunt. Carolyn Meredith, Ursula Andress, is the huntress armed with a high-caliber Bosch shotgun, looking for a 10th victim, Marcello Poletti, Marcello Mastroianni, and he's the victim. He's reluctant to kill Meredith as he's not sure whether she is his hunter or not, because the victims don't know who the hunter is, but later because they become romantically involved. So that's pretty much it. And my tongue went funny just after I had that dark chocolate. The movie is basically style over substance. There's no two ways around that. Elio Petri, who was a communist, as indeed were a lot of movie directors at the time in Italy, really wanted to do a kind of satire on capitalism and the evils of television and media, and all of those kind of things that were very much an issue around that time, with Marshall McLuhan's books coming out and all of the other beginnings of people discovering how media manipulates the public, and as we've now turned it around in the 21st century, how the public manipulates the media. There is a reference to this film in a more recent film. If you remember the Austin Powers movies, which again were another exercise in style over substance, the band that Austin Powers is the lead singer of in the first Austin Powers movie is called Ming T. It's a reference to the 10th Victim, because one of the companies who are trying to look at getting sponsorships for the various hunters and victims in the story is called the Ming T Company. So there's a bit of a reference there to this film in an Austin Powers film. Now, this, as I said, this is a style over substance. It stars Marcello Mastroianni with dyed blonde hair, and he doesn't look bad like that. It's a bit of a difference. It kind of differentiates him from the other roles he did at the time and afterwards. Things like, of course, La Dolce Vita and 8½, and those things he did with Fellini. This was very much a lighter film, and it was produced by Sophia Loren's husband, by the way, Carlo Ponti. And it's, it is style over substance. The clothing is incredibly groovy. Marcello Mastroianni wears these terrific insect-like sunglasses at various times. He has a little robot that gives him back rubs. It's basically a really dinky-looking robot that's got little baby doll hands on the end of its arms, and it gives him a massage, and it's almost like a pet. So these tiny touches of futurism just in the design of the thing, which make it kind of interesting from that kind of retro 60s futuristic kind of style. And the other thing is, too, that they try to build a world in this film, which is an interesting thing, mostly through the things people say and also their choices of location, things like that. There's a scene at the start of the film that they looks like they did film it in New York City with a hunter and a victim traveling through New York City and eventually ending up in an S&M bar, basically, where we meet the Caroline Meredith character, played by Ursula Andress, who has the most dangerous and potentially painful and grooviest weapon I've seen in a movie for a long time, which, of course, is a very spiky-looking bra that shoots bullets. Now, if you look at the physics of that, and I've talked to women about this, it's going to hurt. Basically, if you have a bra that shoots bullets, the recoil is not going to be pleasant for Peter Cook and Dudley Moore once called the busty substances. But leaving that alone, it looks very cool, and seeing Ursula Andress in a silver spiky bikini is not something to be shrugged off lightly. And Ursula Andress, never a deep actress, never somebody who really went into any kind of method or process for her acting. She looked very good. But pretty much that's it. She looked pretty good, and never a great actress, but very much in the feel of this film, style over substance. And one of the things that I really love about this film, apart from the set designs, which are all kind of low, stylish 1960s Italian design furniture and various appurtenances, is that thing of building up a world that people take for granted that the hunts are going on. And while it's a bit simplistic to think that the way to avoid war is to let people shoot each other in a licensed venue or a licensed reality TV thing, and again, this film does have a little bit of a futuristic thing there where the hunts are a form of reality television that is incredibly popular with the masses. This, of course, is a trope that has been in a number of subsequent films, things like The Running Man with Arnold Schwarzenegger in it, based on the Stephen King short story, and Series 7, and any number of other films based on the same thing. And of course, it's not new with this one either. It goes back to Most Dangerous Game in the 1930s, and the original story that was based on. So these ideas aren't new, but this particular iteration of them is incredibly stylish and a lot of fun. And when you sit back and look at it, there is a difference to the world it creates than our modern world. There are differences in people's attitudes. Cops only stop hunters so they can look at their licenses, for instance, which is totally alien to the way we know cops and criminals in our time. There's an incredible kind of media pack that talk to hunters and victims at various times and ask them questions. Do you believe in God? All these kind of intrusive questions that paparazzi ask, and also interviewers ask of people these days. And of course, La Dolce Vita, the original film starring Marcello Mastroianni, is where the word paparazzi comes from. Paparazzo was one of Marcello's friends in La Dolce Vita, and of course in Italian it means sparrows, so they hop around like sparrows taking the crumbs from the celebrities that that they're involved with. Now, the other thing that takes this movie kind of out of the ordinary is the extraordinary music by Piero Piccioni, and I like it so much that I made part of it my ringtone for my phone. I'll just play the theme song. There are three different versions of the theme song. There's an instrumental version. There's a version in Italian. In this movie, the version I've got of it is dubbed in Italian. It's not dubbed. It is subtitled from the original Italian. The music I'm going to play is the English language version of the theme song called Spiral Waltz by Piero Piccioni. And it's very, very groovy. It's got that kind of 60s Euro vibe to it, which I find very attractive for no really good reason.
Just tap on deadly but nice. Better think twice. If you fall for me, you will soon find my lips are on fire, but I'm made of ice. I wanna play a game of love with you. Let's try some kissing for a start. But when I play with you, you'll lose your heart. Love, love, love me. Come on, love me. My lips are on fire, but I'm made of ice. Come to me, let's embrace. Don't pretend to resist me. I know you can't wait to call me up, touch me and kiss me. Beware, beware, you've been warned. My lips are on fire, but I'm made of ice. Try to thrill me. Please caress and obsess and possess me all night through. Since you don't have a chance, why don't you give in? Your heart's the target, I will win. Might as well enjoy it. Come here, my love, talk no more, let's begin. My lips are on fire, but I made a vow.
There have been some accusations about this film that it's very misogynistic, and Elio Petri has had that accusation laid on him about his particular iteration of the Robert Sheckley short story, but I really can't see that. I think it's about two people. I kind of kept the sexual dimension out of it to the extent of whether Marcella likes or doesn't like women. He is being hassled by his wife and his mistress as well at various times through the film. But that's kind of a trope that's very much in play with a lot of Italian comedies at the time, that men are henpecked by women, and part of this, the arc of a number of Italian comedies at the time, is that quest for a guy to escape from the regard of women in a lot of senses of the word. And I think that may be part of the Italian culture at the time, that Catholicism, that mother focus thing that a lot of Americans at the time shared as well, that kind of mummy culture thing, where if the keepers of the culture were the church and the mothers in a family, so that kind of escape from female influence is very much part of the way Italians made their films at the time. And you can see aspects of that as well in La Dolce Vita and a number of other movies by Fellini, that kind of a feeling of oppressiveness about the influence of women that guys had at the time. The interesting thing that I find about this film, apart from all of the other ones that I've just mentioned, I should stop saying that, is that Marcello Mastroianni was never particularly an active actor. He was very much a passive actor. Things happened to his characters rather than him acting to make things happen. And to put an actor like Marcello Mastroianni into a movie which is about a chase to kill people is an interesting thing. I mean, even in this film, Marcello is a very passive character who, to a large extent, is acted upon by other characters. He's pushed along by, he's got an agent, he's got the people who run the hunt, he's got the people obviously chasing him. And that kind of passivity makes an odd juxtaposition with the theme of the movie in a lot of ways, but I think he works it. He looks great with the cropped dyed blonde hair and the stylish black clothing he wears a lot of the time. And another thing is, they've got a lot of those kind of 1960s science fiction films. Everybody wore tunics of some kind. And that happens in this film as well. There are a lot of people going around wearing shiny plastic tunics of various kinds. Mostly the guys, because the women are dressed up fantastically, but guys tend to wear kind of like almost like Chairman Mao suits of various kinds with various kind of appurtenances to them. But I found that really an interesting thing about, particularly 1960s Italian science fiction films. They're empty. They've got absolutely no content, but they look fantastic. They really are stylish. And there are various bits around Roma. There was a lot of new building going on post-war, so there were a lot of new buildings in very much the kind of Bauhaus style. So there was a lot of kind of pseudo-futurism built into the new architecture of Rome, juxtaposed, of course, against the old architecture of Rome. And, in fact, this movie does climax in a gunfight in the Colosseum in Rome. So they kind of go from that futurism back to the history thing as a part of this film. And and it just kind of gives a richness to the environment in which the film takes place that will be lacking in a number of other films where somebody trying to be futuristic will only film totally futuristic sets and in totally futuristic looking locations without realizing that in the future there are old buildings with the new buildings. And I mean, I remember thinking about this driving around Melbourne, where you can go from seeing this great big new sporting arena down by the Yarra River, which basically looks like a giant honeycomb donut, and then you drive in down, say, Collins Street, and you've got all of these 19th century buildings you drive past. So the future and the past coexist. And this film, unlike a lot of films of its time and later, don't realise that you need to have that contrast to really kind of have a richly imagined futuristic scene in a film. Unless, you know, it's a totally new place, like somewhere on another planet. If you're filming something on Earth in the future, you need to have that kind of contrast between the old and the new, and the weirdly designed new and the rectilinear designs of the older times, which is, of course, a 21st century thing. But at the time, geometry denoted futurism in a lot of these films. Are very much a square, blocky building was seen as futuristic, whereas the older buildings had all of those arches and pillars and things like that, that is a hangover from 19th and earliest 20th century architecture. But there's not too much else to say about La Decima Vittima. It's a good, fun movie to watch. Very stylish. I always find when Marcello Mastroianni is on the scene, I don't look at anybody else on the scene, which is, of course, part of that charisma. Even though he is a passive actor, there's always something going on there. It's interesting to watch his process as an actor, where he does minimal things, but it has great effect. So that's all I'm going to talk about on that one. If you haven't seen it, definitely see it. Ursula Andress looks great, as indeed do another number of the other women in it, and there are other women in the film, among whom are Elsa Martinelli, a very, very attractive actress, playing his girlfriend, and a lady called Luce Bonifaci, who plays his wife, and I think Elsa Martinelli plays his mistress. I got a bit confused with that at various times, but it's a stylish film, and if you like seeing chicks firing guns, then this is definitely one of those movies that you're going to get your rocks off with. Another break now, and then I'm going to come back with the final program, also known as The Last Days of Man on Earth, starring John Finch and Jenny Ronacre.
Got the blues in Paris. Paris blues called agité. How can I be blue in Paris? Easy, 'cause you're far away. Can't lose this blues, this agité. Eiffel Tower. Funny taxis, kids at play. Paris without you is lonesome, yearning more and more each day. Can't lose this blues, this agitate.
Thought I'd suave it up there a little bit. That is, of course, Nat King Cole singing Agité, which is kind of based on a tune that was used in, I think, Paris Blues, Paul Newman, Joanne Woodward movie in the 1950s, but I could be wrong, often am. Let's move along to the third and final film of the podcast, The Final Program, also known as The Last Days of Man on Earth, which was the American title, I think, because when people said The Final Program, they probably thought it was a TV series. Anyway, it's based on a novel by Michael Moorcock, a very, very well-known science fiction writer, and Michael Moorcock hated the guts out of the film. He really did have no time for it at all. Reportedly, he was highly disappointed in this film because of its many plots unrelated to the book and the final image of the all-purpose human being portrayed in it. Having said that, and I've got my disagreements with Michael Moorcock, he did a very anti-pornography essay about 15 years ago where he supported the belief systems of Andrea Dworkin, amongst other people. And, I have our disagreements, though. He doesn't know about me disagreeing with him. Having said that, I do like a lot of his writing. Incredibly detailed. He was doing meta before meta became a word. And the final program, the book of it, which is one of the four books in the Cornelius Quartet, which are very, very different between one another, is a favourite of mine. So I'll just go into a plot synopsis of the movie. It doesn't stray enormously from the plot of the book, less so than a lot of science fiction movies made in 1973 and around that time, which this one was. First of all, I'll say the director of this film was a guy called Robert West, who did a number of other interesting genre works, and I'll just grab my sheet on the man. There we go. Robert Frost is born in London in 1927, and he still has a pulse to this day. He made a couple of other groovy movies, The Abominable Dr. Fibes and Dr. Fibes Rises Again, with our cult god Vincent Price in them. The final program. He also did a really good suspense thriller in 1970 called And Soon the Darkness, which is recommended. And he made a shit movie which had William Shatner and Ernest Borgnine in it called The Devil's Reign. It probably killed off his career, according to some sources. But his only subsequent film after that was a softcore sex movie filmed in Greece called Aphrodite. So he's done some television work as well subsequent to that. But I kind of like Robert Frost's stuff. It's never flashy and over the top, but he was a good journeyman director of these kind of things, and he seemed to have a feel for genre work. Now, on to the synopsis that I promised you minutes and minutes ago. The story starts with the burial of Jerry Cornelius' father. Jerry Cornelius is the character played by John Finch in this film, a Nobel Prize-winning scientist who has developed the final program, a design for a perfect self-replicating human being. A group of scientists, including Dr. Smiles, played by Graham Crowden, and Miss Brenner, played by Jenny Runica, who's very hot. And the formidable Miss Brenner, who consumes her lovers, try to persuade Cornelius to locate the microfilm containing his father's final program, which is believed to be hidden somewhere in the family-owned house. Things are further complicated by the apparent disappearance of Cornelius' sister Catherine, for whom he has incestuous feelings, and the activities of his evil druggy brother Frank, and the involvement of other characters such as his old friend Shades, and others among them, including a guy called Wrongway Lindbergh, an ex-military guy who's now a gunrunner in this kind of semi-post-apocalyptic future that the film has, played by Sterling Hayden, who I'll talk about a little bit more later. Okay, Jerry attacks the house, which has got an immense number of traps and various ways of killing people in it, and things evolve through the plot of the film, with Jerry trying to find out about the final program and the scientists trying to, while they know that the apocalypse is coming because it's the end of the Dark Ages according to the Hindu Kali Yuga theory, and they go to a hidden Nazi submarine base in northern Norway, where things just basically go to shit. Going to play a little bit of sound from the movie now and then come back and talk about some of the actors who take part in it.
After an emergency meeting of the Senate, the President agreed that the sum of $600 million be paid as compensation to the five remaining survivors. There has been no further statement from the Pentagon, although it is understood here in Washington that a full-scale inquiry will be set up in the next 18 months. In the meantime, all training flights over Europe have been cancelled. From Hammerfest, North Lapland. Reports have been received of the death of the eminent biophysicist, Dr. Alexander Cornelius, who for the past 9 years has lived in comparative isolation, working in the field of advanced genetics. It is not yet known whether his elder son, Nobel Prize winner Jerry Cornelius, will continue with his father's research.
Cornelius.
Hello, darling.
We haven't seen much of you lately.
No, how's the stargazing business?
Complain. How about you, dear? Would you like your chart read, your fortune?
Oh, come on. Forget it.
I've been doing them now for 60 years.
Five. You didn't even start till the age of the government.
Who have you been talking to?
You, Dolly Box.
They should have listened to me, shouldn't they? I mean, when I tell them the apocalypse is on them, they bloody well ought to listen.
Let's talk about some of the actors now. John Finch, the guy who plays Jerry Cornelius, an actor, he did a few Hammer films in the late 60s and early 1970s, and he was set up to star in a movie directed by a guy who used to make television commercials, a fellow called Ridley Scott, and the movie was Alien. He was going to play Kane in Alien originally. John Hurt got the role and ended up having a chest burster pop out of his guts. That could very easily have been John Finch had his health been better. He was the first choice for the role by Ridley Scott, so unfortunately missed opportunity there because of illness. Really interesting guy. Jenny Runica's in it as well. Very attractive actress. He didn't do a hell of a lot apart from this film, really. Let me just bring up my IMDb on Jenny Reinecker and give you a little bit of a rundown on what she did. Red-headed actress, so let's see. It would help if I could type, wouldn't it? Okay, let's see what I've got there on Jenny Reinecker. Here we go. Born 18th of August 1946, so she's got a few birthdays at the moment. She's 64. She was born in Cape Town, relocated to London as a child. She was in the original London cast of O Calcutta, the quite nudie and rudy stage play, which was written, amongst other people, by Kenneth Tynan and John Lennon. So that she was in The Canterbury Tales by Pier Paolo Pasolini, John Huston's Macintosh Man, Michelangelo Antonioni's The Passenger, Derek Jarman's Jubilee, in which she starred as Elizabeth I, and was in the original version of Brideshead Revisited. So she's since become a stage director, which is an interesting thing. And her character, Miss Brenner, is of course a nod to one of the other British science fiction writers of the time, John Brenner. And she kind of plays it with a kind of combination of sexiness and a kind of schoolmistressy sternness, which is quite interesting as well. Like John Finch, she knows that the film is supposed to be a comedy, even though some of the other actors are maybe less aware of it than they are, and they have quite fun. It was one of the last roles by Hugh Griffith, a Welsh actor who you might remember way back in the 1950s played the guy who trained the horses that Charlton Heston used in Ben-Hur. Very interesting actor. Patrick McGee, another Irish actor, who I believe was in Dementia 13, Francis Ford Coppola's first film. Harry Andrews is in it, another great English character actor with a fantastically enormous chin. And as I said, Sterling Hayden. Now I'm going to play some of Sterling Hayden's dialogue from the film now, where he's supplying a phantom jet to Jerry Cornelius, who wants to take his sister to Cambodia to recover from the machinations and the drugs that she's been given by his brother Frank. So I'll just play a little bit of that and talk about why I find Sterling Hayden such an interesting guy.
You miserable son of a bitch.
Morning, sweetheart. You got the message?
Well, now, Jerry.
Have any luck?
I want you to brace yourself because I think that I can get you a Phantom.
Oh, really? What mark?
What mark? An F4D. And that means that you're going to have a J67 GE15 turbojets APQ109 radar control. Also an ASQ weapon release computer. And on top of that, you're going to have an ASG lead control gyro. And if you can believe it or not, beyond that, there's an ASN63 inertial navigation system. Amen. And I doubt that you'll do better.
And what about the bloody drop tanks?
Well, what about the bloody drop tanks?
Well, I need them, don't I? I want to push the range to over 3,000.
Over 3,000? Where the fuck are you going? I don't care where you're going because they're standard equipment.
Well, they weren't on the last one.
And you didn't get the last one from me, did you? Huh?
No, I didn't get the last one from you.
And you won't make that mistake again, will you? And now, if you don't mind my asking, why, where are you going?
Somewhere with a bit of sun. Cambodia, I fancy.
Ah, Cambodia, eh?
She'll need the rest.
Brotherly love, eh, Jerry?
She's all I've got, really.
So it's a nice little bit by Sterling Hayden, who was in Stanley Kubrick's The Killing. He was in The Long Goodbye, directed by Robert Altman. He did crime films in the 1950s. He was kind of a beefcake star in the 1950s, and then had an unpleasant for everybody concerned marriage breakup. And so he had a parental visit, and he had about four kids at the time. So he and the kids hopped on a boat and sailed to Tahiti. He took his kids away to Tahiti. He's actually written an autobiography about that, a book called Wanderer, which is about his love of boats and that part of his life where he ran away to the South Seas with his children. And it's quite an interesting read. It's a very lyrical book, a little bit Hemingway influenced, but I found it a terrific read that when I read it. And I always liked him for that. He was a rogue in the good sense of the word. And very fond of not only alcohol, but he was very fond of a bit of a chuff now and then, very much in the style of Robert Mitchum. And he always kind of brought a certain gravitas to the roles that he portrayed. And in this one, he's a kind of almost a Hunter S. Thompson type character in the short time he's in this film, and quite enjoyable for that. John Finch's Jerry Cornelius is great. He's got the kind of gothy suits, gothic era suits, and the black hair and the slight goth look and the black fingernails. And it's pretty obvious that he's read at least one of the books with Jerry Cornelius in it. And he brings a kind of nice light touch to it as well. Jerry Cornelius, even in the books, is always a bit of a comic figure in a sense, a harlequin, as the subsequent books prove. And then ultimately, there's a story arc through that. I mean, most of the books that Moorcock did with Jerry Cornelius, and he did lend the character to other people as well to write short stories about Jerry Cornelius. He was kind of like an all-purpose hero kind of character that during the 1960s new wave of science fiction, where people were going literary with their science fiction and maybe just not sticking to the nuts and bolts of science, but were looking at the psychological aspects of things and society and social interactions and things like that. Jerry Cornelius was a character that Moorcock lent out, and it played through that. It was very much a character of the 1960s and 1970s London scene in a lot of ways. And I do recommend the books. They're not always an easy read, but I do enjoy them when I read them. And they're like Kim Newman's novels are later. They're laminated with cultural references. They're just kind of thick with meta data incorporated into them, and in that I always find them fun. I always like books where if you want to dig in, there's always a little more to see, and I find that with the Cornelius novels. I don't particularly care that Michael Moorcock didn't like this film. Really don't give a shit. I'll tell you about how I first saw it. The first time I saw it, it was showing, I think, in the Winter Garden in Rose Bay in Sydney, or maybe down at the Twin Cinemas in Double Bay over in the posh end of town down by the harbour. And I was living in the southwestern suburbs around Liverpool, and I travelled literally 2 hours to see this film because I'd heard about it, read about it in magazines. And I enjoyed it at the time. It was silly. It had some nudity in it, which for a teenage guy like me was always a plus, and to a certain extent still is. And yeah, I kind of enjoyed it. There was a lot of critical brouhaha about it at the time, saying, particularly around in the science fiction magazine, saying it wasn't true to Michael Moorcock's vision of Jerry Cornelius and all that sort of thing. But I really didn't give a shit. I enjoyed the movie. I liked the silliness of it. I liked the technology of it, where you have brains in tanks and Bentleys with pills and whiskey in the glove box. And basically, again, this is a little bit of style over substance, though. There is some very funny, sly dialogue in the film. And Jerry Cornelius travelling around with a gun that shoots little steel needles in it rather than your usual big bang-bang lead bullet guns. And a house that defends itself by flashing lights at intruders that cause pseudo-epilepsy, and having chess sets built into the walls that shoot swords out of them, and gas canisters that are set off if somebody does the wrong thing. The house is a weapon. It is quite an interesting little motif in this one. And it does have a certain post-apocalyptic style. There are sly hints that the world is falling apart. For instance, Amsterdam has been nuked. And there's a scene with Jerry walking through London, and there are all these derelict cars piled up in the middle of London. So on a not enormous budget, it does kind of have a certain stylish, apocalyptic look to it, which is not entirely uninteresting. The soundtrack's very unusual. It's kind of got a certain dreamy kind of soundtrack with Jerry Mulligan, a famous saxophone player, playing a kind of laconic sax riff through various parts of the film. Jerry's brother, Frank, is played by Derek O'Connor, a character actor who, from the year Dot, looked disreputable. You might remember he played Ben Affleck's priest friend in the very ill-fated and ill-conceived Daredevil movie a few years back. So he's still definitely acting there. Ronald Lacey's in it playing Specs, one of Jerry's friends. Shades. Ronald Lacey, you might remember, played the evil Nazi with the coat hanger in Raiders of the Lost Ark. So there are lots of little bits of the film. George Koulouris is in it. He worked with Orson Welles in a number of projects in the early days. I kind of like this film as much for its flaws as I do for its virtues. There's not another film like it, which is always a plus with a movie. I hate movies that follow trends and follow fads. I'm sure there are going to be any number of kind of meta war films come out after Inglourious Basterds, for instance, and Pulp Fiction, you know, caused a lot of films to come out that were very much owed to it. And I like the fact that this one's kind of standalone. It's based on a solid literary work. It's not always successful in its adaptation of that, but it has a bit of style, it's a bit of fun, and it's very much tongue-in-cheek, and that's a virtue as far as I'm concerned. So definitely see it. It's called The Final Program. It's also called The Last Days of Man on Earth, depending on which patch of dirt you're standing on. And I'll be back with the feedback very, very soon.
My father's incubator, I can understand. Dual, I can understand, just. But how do they relate? I mean, what's the end product?
Microfilm is the link between the two processors. Dual has been ready for some days. The sunroom you've seen for yourself.
So, what's about to happen?
We're about to produce an all-purpose human being. An hermaphrodite in every respect. Self-fertilizing, self-regenerating, immortal. Repeating itself over and over again. Retaining knowledge with the help of Jewel.
And you... do you think the two brains are enough to accomplish all this?
Yes, and two bodies.
Oh, two bodies. That means you and Dimitri.
Yes, something like that.
Okay, on to the feedback. And yes, we did receive some this time around. So I'm just going to give you the voicemail number again to give calls on this. There is some confusion on it, as Rupert's voicemail that I'm going to play in a moment will tell you. The voicemail number is 206-350-5440, or you can just go Paleo Cinema, lowercase no dash, on Skype and leave me a voicemail there. I do have voicemail attached to my Skype. So moving along, here's a voicemail from Rupert.
Hey Terry, it's Rupert. Sorry, I called in earlier today, but it was to the old voicemail number, and I noticed you have a new number, so I'm not sure if it went in or not, or if you got it or not. But if you did, then no need to play this one. I was just talking about The High and the Mighty and how I heard you mentioned that film in passing on the last episode I heard, and that it's been a film that's fascinated me with the these airline disaster sort of type. Although I think High and the Mighty is a little different. But just for saying, I would love to hear you cover it.
I think I got a second voicemail from Rupert, and I'll play that now.
Hey Terry, it's Rupert again. I was just going to say, I'm sure you saw this, but really exciting announcement from Criterion, I think today. They announced their November releases, one of which is a favorite of yours and mine, Night of the Hunter, which is coming in a nice special edition and Blu-ray, which I'm really, really excited about. On top of which, they have a series, and I forget what it's called right now, but it's of 60s and 70s films. It's like a box set. It includes, and it's in Blu-ray too, but it includes like Easy Rider, Five Easy Pieces, Last Picture Show, King of Marvin Gardens, which is one of my favorites, and then some rarer stuff like Drive He Said, which has never been available on video, which is going to be exciting to see that. I'm not sure if you're a fan of that one or not, but I think Head, the Monkees movie is in there, and there's like a couple more. But sounds like a spectacular box set. I mean, Criterion is just on an unstoppable roll this year with their, you know, fantastic Blu-ray releases. So anyway, just wanted to let you and the listeners know about it. I thought you'd be pretty excited, as I was when I saw that today. I think there's one more they announced. Charlie Chaplin's Modern Times is also coming out in Blu-ray. So that's exciting, too. That's all I got. Okay, bye.
Yeah, thanks, Rupert. And by the way, keep up the great work with the interviews that you're doing for the guys over at The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema. I always enjoy them very much. Yeah, that box set is really tempting me. I'm going to have a little bit of spare cash at some time fairly soon, and I want to get it, for totally silly reasons, I want to get the widescreen Criterion edition of the Monkees movie Head. Yep, I'm shallow, what can I say? But getting things like Five Easy Pieces and Drive, he said, and other films like that as a bonus on that is definitely worthwhile. Great cinema from the late 60s, early 1970s, and well worth our time and our money. So I appreciate you giving me a heads up on that too. I didn't hear about it before you told me, and I would have hated to have missed it. So we also got a couple more voicemails, and I won't even introduce the next one. I'll let the person introduce himself.
T-Man Frost. This is Dr. Zom. Just saw that today was podcast day, and I forgot, but spent the day at the old Lunatic Asylum tour, and watched a few movies. Watched the original Get Carter with Michael Caine. Like it a lot. Conversations with Other Women with Helena Bonham Carter and Aaron Eckhart. And just finished watching a movie called Puerto Vallarta Squeeze from 2004 with Scott Glenn and Harvey Keitel, Craig Wasson. I was a straight-to-video DVD, but I got to tell you, wasn't too bad. Sure, there were some spots in there that were kind of, you know, but, you know, had some, you know, fairly decent cast, so it wasn't too bad. Scott Glenn, I don't know if I'd say he's a great actor, but I like him. Also liked him in the original Man on Fire. Silverado also in... I really liked him in his small part in Silence of the Lambs. And, you know. So anyway, that begs the question. What does Terry Frost of Paleo Cinema think of Mr. Scott Glenn? And are there any movies that Scott Glenn was in or that he co-starred in or maybe had a small role in that you enjoyed? And if this isn't the right phone number, I did this all for nothing. Nothing. Zom. Out.
Thanks for that, Zom. It wouldn't be the same without the raspberry at the end of it. My favorite Scott Glenn role. And by the way, thanks for giving me the heads up on that movie starring Scott Glenn and Craig Wasson, amongst other people. Definitely got to find that one. Anyway, his favourite Scott Glenn role, The Challenge, written by John Sayles, starring Scott Glenn, Toshiro Mifune. I think it's from the early 1980s, where he plays an American boxer who ends up in a samurai school in Japan, run by Toshiro Mifune, whose brother basically has a big rivalry against him. And one of the things they do in the film is they bury Scott Glenn up to his neck, and he eats bugs to keep his energy levels up. Now, insect eating is always a sign of a quality actor. If they're willing to go to the extent of eating insects, or as in the case of Old Boy, the Korean film, eating live octopi, You get street cred points for doing that, basically. So that's probably my favourite Scott Glenn film. Yes, I think he was fine in Silence of the Lambs, playing the FBI director who was running Clarice Starling. And he's got a certain gravitas and a certain quality about him, which tends to be underused in cinema. They tend to want people who have smooth heads, and Scott Glenn has a craggy kind of face at the moment. Unless he changes it, of course, which is on the cards. But definitely he's got to go on the tough guy pantheon, really, doesn't he, for films of the 70s, 80s, and up into the 90s. I got a second voicemail from Zom as well. By the way, I've got to find that challenge again. I haven't seen it in about 20 years. Saw it on VHS back in the day. Going to have to go to my usual subterranean sources and see if I can locate a copy of that one, because it might be worth watching again.
T-Matt, this is Zom again, and I just wanted to say, Daddy, that for all you listeners out there who aren't friends with Dr. Zom on Facebook, check it out, Daddy-O. Find T-Man on Facebook. Look under his friends and find Dr. Zom. Be his friend. He needs a lot of friends. It's the gift that keeps on giving, baby. And while I have you on the line again, brother, I just wanted to say that there is a documentary out there that I have found and that I have grown to really like, to love, and to really appreciate. And like Dr. Zom, it is the gift that keeps on giving. Because not only is the documentary very good, but the documentary is about a group of swing musicians, Daddy, known as the Gits, G-I-T-S. It was made in 2005, and it is a very, very sad story of a group on the rise, ready to hit the big time and to have it all taken away in a tragic event. Now, I don't want to go on acting silly with this subject anymore, because this documentary touched Dr. Zom's heart. But find the movie The Gits. Find it on DVD, find it on Netflix, and give it a look. I think that you'll really like it. I think that you'll really like the music if you find their CDs. They're on iTunes. I downloaded all their albums. And I must say that though I find the music very, very good, I find the documentary very, very good. The story of Mia Zapata really touches Zom's heart, and that's why I want to spread the word, baby. Check it out. Listen to Terry Frost, listen to Paleo Cinema, and by God, be a good person for a change, and love somebody for a change, affect somebody's life, do some good, spread the word, Dr. Zom in the hizzy, and Zom is eight, and that's all I have to say, baby. So, oot.
Thanks, Zom. You always make a podcast for me, man. The Gits movie, I just found it, again, from my usual suspects. And I'm in the process of downloading it as we speak. So thank you very much for that heads up. Always happy to look at recommendations. So really on that. And please friend Zom up on Facebook through my one. The clue is his surname is... It starts with the reverse of Zom. I'm not going to go any further than that. I'm not going to give away the guy's identity. But he's also started a Facebook group called Poop Syndicate, a pastiche of the old Pop Syndicate, people who royally butt-fucked a number of podcasters around the place by totally changing their company policy regarding podcasting. So, definitely friend him up. He's always got interesting movies he talks about on his Facebook page, and he has been a great and loyal listener and friend to this podcast. So thank you for that, Zom. I really should thank a whole bunch of other podcasters around. Big Willie and the Samurai over at Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema, Vince and Nick over at the Boom Movie Cast, Action Attraction, and of course Middle Mikey there, and just everybody else in the podcasting community, Grant Watson as well. Guys, keep it up. We're doing something wonderful here. We're enriching various cultures by doing this, and I'm going to be talking about that a little bit at my AussieCon 4, at least one of my AussieCon 4 program items. So I'm really looking forward to kind of interacting with other people who in various ways are into new media, and that's what podcasting is. It's a new medium. It's an egalitarian radio thing, and I'm really going to enjoy interacting with people about that. As I said, you go to the paleo-cinema.blogspot.com website and you'll find my program for the things I'm doing at AussieCon 4. If you're able to make it, please do. If not, I hope there's some kind of streaming video or something like that going on at some stage. But it's going to be bigger than Ben-Hur and the Ten Commandments and Avatar combined. So I am really looking forward to that, and I really should start getting my shit together as far as packing stuff to take with me. I'm only commuting because it's not too far away. I'm not staying at a hotel, but I want to get my IT needs happening, you know, like the netbook, and I may get a chance to record a few interviews with a few people using my portable podcasting gear. So we're going to see how that rolls. And please, feedback, go to the front of the podcast. It'll tell you where to give the feedback. Thank you very much for your attention. Thanks for listening. Sorry about the audio problems this time around. To be honest with you, they were much worse than listening to the podcast would indicate. So thanks again. I'll see you guys in 3 weeks, and take care and enjoy your movie viewing.